There are a number of persons who are here who weren't with us yesterday. There are probably some people that were with us yesterday that aren't here. So what I said last night, I'm going to modify. Last night I said I would do part two. So I'm going to do part two in maybe three sentences, because some people that are with us weren't here for part one. So here goes. Yesterday, we discussed like a little overview of Canto 1, Srimad Bhagavatam, ending with the 19th chapter of First Canto, Srimad Bhagavatam. Overview of Canto 1, ending with chapter 19. We focused on Maharaj Parikshit's prayer to the sages who had come at the time of his imminent death, 7 days remaining before he would die. And he welcomed those sages that had come from all different directions. He expressed that normally persons of your caliber consider persons like me, that is, kings who are dealing with power and money and material energy, you distance yourselves from persons like us because you're on your way to liberation and spiritual perfection. And we're involved in the material energy, so you normally treat us like rubbish. You keep it a distant place. But you came because you're very merciful. And he then prayed, please speak Krishna Katha. He then said, this is the Lord, this reversal we were discussing, little reversals, like suddenly I'm now going to die. This is the kindness of the Lord because it's his special mercy to help me become detached, knowing that I'll die in 7 days. Out of fear of death, I'm becoming detached from my many attachments, family life and my many attachments. Krishna is very kind. You're very kind. Krishna is very kind. And the next thing he said was, please speak Krishna Katha, because by speaking Krishna Katha, I'll stay in touch with Krishna, and in that condition, I'm fearless. Let this mystical snake bird or whatever the thing is that the young Brahmin boy created, let it come. I'm ready. I'm fearless because you're being kind upon me. The Lord is being kind upon me. You're speaking Krishna Katha. Then he requested three benedictions. One, please bless me that I may remain attached to the personality of Godhead, that I may always be in the association of his devotees, and that I may have a friendly disposition towards all living entities. So part two was almost identical request with a long storyline coming before it of the florist, whose name was Sudama, the same name as Krishna's boyhood friend, Sudama, same name but a different person, where Sudama knew that Krishna was going to be coming. He heard from the local people, but he just had this intuition, Krishna's going to come to my home. So Krishna, there's a detail. Being a florist, it was part of his business to gather very nice quality flowers. So he heard they have very nice flowers in Vrindavan, and Mathura is only a few hours from Vrindavan. So on occasion, he went to Vrindavan to gather very, very special flowers. One day, while gathering flowers, he saw Krishna and Balaram with the cowherd boys in the forest of Vrindavan. And needless to say, he was attracted to the all-attractive Krishna. So he stood staring and in wonder and amazement at Krishna for a long time. Then he gathered some flowers and went back. And then he made regular trips to Vrindavan to gather flowers and see Krishna. So he developed very strong and very natural attachment to Krishna. So when Krishna came to Mathura, instead of him going to Vrindavan, he was very happy. He heard that Krishna was coming. He went out of his house to find Krishna and paid his obeisances to Krishna, invited Krishna to his home. Krishna came to his home. And he said, that you have placed your lotus feet in my home. Now I can consider that my everything, my home, my family, my whole life is now sanctified. Just you placed your two lotus feet in my home. Please have a seat and offered natural what you offer to a guest in your home. And Krishna was sitting there and he looked at on the wall and he saw a half-finished garland hanging. He didn't say anything. He just saw the garland. Because the florist was a devotee and very cultured, Krishna didn't have to say anything. He understood. Krishna wants that garland. And he had saved some very special flowers. So he finished completing the garland and offered it to Krishna. Another went to Balaram. And Krishna said, you have pleased me so much by your devotion. You know, it's just offering a garland. But you pleased me so much by your devotion that I'd like to offer you a benediction. Please ask for anything that you would like. Well, I think I'd like an iPad and maybe a... I could use a new car and our washing machine is kind of old. We can use another washing machine. That's not what he asked for. He said, just that you have come to my home, my life is fulfilled. But I know it is your desire that I ask for some benediction. So here's the benediction. I'd like attachment to your eternal service. Lifetime after lifetime, may I simply be engaged in serving you. Same list. And I want the association of those who love you, your dear devotees. May I always have their association. And the last one he phrased a little differently. He said, I may have affection for all living entities, your part and parcel living entities. Krishna said, so be it. So, the synergy between Maharaj Parikshit at the time of death, requesting these things, the florist, who was also a very, very exalted devotee, even he had imbibed some of the mood of the residents of Vrindavan just by his seeing the associates of Krishna and Vrindavan engaging in their loving pastimes very intimately with him. So these are very wonderful desires. There's the Sanskrit word sankalpa. Sankalpa means intention or hankering or that which you wish. When we have our japa retreats, we often begin with a little sankalpa message. Why have you come to this japa retreat? What's your intention? What is it that you wish to accomplish? What is your sankalpa? And then you write it down. So it helps you focus on what you're doing. It gives you like a spiritual lens, a lens of spiritual desire to look through. Because there can be sankalpas that are not so material. They can be the opposite kind, in fact. I want to get back at the person who hurt me. That's my intention. Some persons have such intention. So, these prayer is like a sankalpa. This is, in my relationship with you, Krishna, the service, the florist, the service that I've rendered to you, this is my wish behind the service, that you may be pleased. And you wish to give something to me, let this be the something. Let this be the nature of our relationship. So that's part two. We're done. Now, today, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 The topic that I'd like to speak about is from Srimad Bhagavatam, but I'd like to do a little prelude to help you focus on the topic. Little ISKCON news, at least ISKCON North America news. Over the past maybe 4 or 5 months, a conversation has awakened again that it'd be very nice to have a congregation development director for North America, like what Lal Gopal is doing here, to have one for the whole of North America, someone that kind of inspires and oversees and helps foster development of the congregations, plural, of North America. So to help us in North America do this, because we've had some false starts in the past, kind of started and sputtered and stopped, I reached out to, do you know Kripa Moya from the UK, Prabhupada disciple or God brother? You know Vaisheshika Prabhu. So he's like the Vaisheshika of the UK. So that gives you like some picture of this person. He's awesome. He's an inspirer. He's scripturally very... As Vaisheshika is in book distribution, he is in congregation development, because the UK is huge congregation. Huge congregation. And he's been the congregation development director for that huge congregation for so many years. And his personality is just... He's just wonderful. He's like lovable, warm... And it's wonderful. Kirtans, everything about him is wonderful. So, I wanted his association as much as I wanted to develop something for North America. So I reached out to him and said, can you help us? Can you kind of like guide us and be a consultant and somehow involved in this? He said, sure, that'd be very nice. So we were discussing. And in the course of discussing, he said something that's now prompting what I'm doing tonight. He said, something that I've experienced over the last 30 years with congregations in the UK, and I'm sure it's not so different in other parts of the world, sometime between 6 months and 3 years after someone begins, congregation member begins, and largely in the UK it's Indian congregation, largely it's Gujarati congregation in the UK, that I didn't know. Since there are two things that arise as stumbling blocks or they commonly, not always, but commonly cause some disturbance for our congregation members. And I've been focusing on these two things. One is impersonalism. You know, something somewhere they've heard or contacted or something, and it causes a disturbance in their smooth progress in Krishna consciousness. And the other is doubts arising from science says this and the Vedas say that, and it gives them a pause. So with that cue in mind, or prompt, I thought I would speak this evening a little bit about what the Vedas say, because you know, from time to time, this comes up with parents, and the children of the parents, or directly the children come to me, or the parents come to me saying, my son or daughter read such and such in school, and they're confused because in the Vedas it says something different than such and such. And how do I address it? Yeah, parents? You've had that? Or, you know, it's because I interact with college students a lot. It's something that they bring up. you know, in their each in their own way, but you know, it's Prabhupada said after the publication of the fifth canto, and you know, the reaction that his own devotees, what to speak of those that aren't devotees, had in hearing what the Vedas say about cosmology. Cosmology is the picture of the universe from the Vedic perspective. There was a lot of, you know, hey, what's going on? It says this, but science says that, kind of thing. So students bring this to my attention. How do I deal with this? In my science class, I'm hearing this. In the Vedas, it says that. You follow what I'm saying? So what I want to do is give you a little bit the Vedic perspective. That's a different picture than Big Bang cosmology and the primordial soup. Once Prabhupada was asked, is there anything comparable in the Vedic picture of things to Big Bang cosmology? And Prabhupada asked, what is that, Big Bang cosmology? And the devotees explained, once upon a time, there was a singularity. You know what a singularity is, right? Singularity means something like unlimited mass compressed in a dimensionless point. Don't ask how the mass got there. Don't ask how it became dimensionless. But once upon a time. And then there was an explosion. Kaboom! And mass went flying in all directions and you got a universe from a singularity. I've discussed this, you know, I remember specifically once it was the IGSA, Indian Graduate Student Association in the University of Houston in Texas. And I was presenting Sadaputta's perspective on Vedic cosmology. And we were having this, you know, at the question and answer session was all this dialogue about Big Bang cosmology. And one of the students said, you know, physicists have calculated down to milliseconds exactly what happened before the Big Bang. And then the kaboom, after the Big Bang, and mass went flying all over the place. And then I asked the question, then what happens? Well, he said, well, there's two different versions. As mass goes flying and flying and flying and flying and flying, at some point, it just keeps flying and it dissipates into space. Because gravity is holding things together, but when it gets to be so far apart, it just, matter just dissipates into space. And the other is, at a certain point, it implodes back upon itself and again merges into a singularity. I said, that's very interesting. What you're telling me is, either model, everything starts from nothing, and it ends up with nothing. So what does that tell about where we are right now? In between nothing and nothing. It's nothing. Okay, that's one picture of the universe, and now we're going to hear another picture of the universe. It comes from something. Presently there's something, and in the end it's something. And that something is the Supreme Person. And as I shared with the University of Houston Indian Graduate Student Association group, the numbers are practically one-to-one matching with what Vedic cosmology says is, you know, about the universe, the size of planets and their orbits and things, cosmological events. And they did it without a telescope. You didn't mount telescopes on a Hubble telescope on a spaceship and send it out into space and take pictures and send the pictures back and then take measurements. They didn't have any of that. But the measurements are almost the same. Now, how do they get that? You know, like even just take the distance between the Earth and the Sun. I don't want to go too far afield. I want to get back to, you know, third canto of Bhagavatam. But there are rishis or seers who had the capacity to receive transcendental knowledge from the transcendental source. That's Narayana, the personality of Godhead. And they received the Vedas, and then they spoke the Vedas, and then they were written down. And they're recording all these empirical cosmological events without any technology, without any guesswork, without even math. Just like, you know, they knew because they received this knowledge. And then it's recorded in the Vedas. And the source of that is a person, and in the end, it goes back to a person, and in between, it's personal. That's the Vedic conception. So you choose nothingness or person, and the quality of life that goes along with both. We're going to close the curtain or no? No. Ringing a bell? No? Yeah, there we go. Okay. Shri Shri Krishna Balaram ki. Krishna Nitai Gornataraj ki. Okay, so I'm going to cover a section of Canto 3, Chapter 5, where the scene that's being described by Maitreya to Vidura is when the living entities, the Vedic picture of time is, and creation is, everything is cyclical. Like we're just going into the end of winter and it's a nice spring and all the flowers, and then it's starting to get warmer and summer comes, and like the seasons are cyclical. But everything in Vedic picture is described as cyclical. It's like a rerun. It's just, you know, if you're going to design something, that's a very practical way to do it. Just, you set it up and it just keeps running. And the thing that moves it is time. There's a whole chapter in the third canto of just describing time. We're going to have our retreat in Gita Nagari. The topic is time, using time in Krishna service. And I'm going to spend some time discussing about time, and with you a little bit also. So at this point, it's Mahavishnu, who's, as you see, Mahavishnu, and he's lying in the causal ocean, and he's enjoying his transcendental lila with his internal potency, who's an expansion of Lakshmi, and her name is Rama Devi. Just like Radha, Krishna, Sitaram, Lakshmi, Narayan, Rama is her name. And this is during the period of cosmic annihilation, which is about 4,320,000,000 years of duration, which is a long time. The living entities are within the, during the period of annihilation, that part of the cycle, the living entities are in a deep sleep state. They're conscious, but consciousness is in a deep sleep state called susupti. That's very much like anesthesia. Anybody here ever have an operation? You were put under anesthesia. So that's what it's like, and without details. When you're under anesthesia, there's no sense of time. Many of you know Prithvisrava Prabhu. You know, remember he had this thing in his throat or his neck, and he was trying to get rid of it, a lump. By natural methods, he tried this and tried that and tried the other thing. It didn't get bigger, but it didn't go away. And then it started to get bigger. And it wasn't cancer, but it was like, he couldn't breathe and swallow. It was like, it was a problem. So he had to have surgery. for the surgery, they gave him anesthesia. He described what it was like. When he came out of his anesthesia, because he had swallowed fluid, maybe blood or other things, he started to cough when the anesthesia wore off, so they gave him more anesthesia. He was under anesthesia for about a day and a half, something like that. And when he came out of anesthesia the second time, he felt like, besides, you know, the pain in his neck, you know, when are they going to do this operation? Because, like, there was no sense of time. It's not like when you wake up, that's another state of consciousness. There's awake, sleep, and then this susupti kind. When you're asleep, there's some sense of time. Like, okay, now it's time to get up. But there's no sense of time in this susupti state. So the 4,320,000,000 years, it's timeless. It's almost like eternal time, because there's no sense of time as we know it. Consciousness is so covered. So the living entities are in this susupti state. And then the Lord has a feeling, which Maitreya is going to describe. So there's four verses I want to read, and the purport of one of those four verses. But the scene, just the scene is part of the beauty of the Bhagavatam. They're way in the north country of India, because just prior to this, Krishna spoke Uddhava Gita to Uddhava, and that was in Vrindavan. And Vrindavan is the north of India. While Krishna was speaking Uddhava Gita to Uddhava, Maitreya was also there. He heard the whole thing first, like, you know, he didn't hear it from somebody, he heard Krishna speak it. Krishna, then, his pastimes were over. He left this world. He gave some service to Uddhava. The specific service was, I descended into this world to give association to my dear devotees. One of the groups of my dear devotees that I didn't get to give my association to are the devotees of Naranarayan, Rishi. Go there and explain to them everything you heard from me, in this way I can give my association to them. Notice the connection between Krishna's words and Krishna's association. Krishna did that in part so he could sustain Uddhava's life after Krishna left, because otherwise Uddhava wouldn't have been able to continue to live, because Krishna was his life and soul. And he also spoke to Maitreya, who was also there, and he gave Maitreya some service. He said, very soon, in just a few days, at this very, no, within a short time, because it happened the same day that Krishna left, Vidura is going to come. And I want you to speak what you've heard to Vidura and enlighten Vidura, my dear devotee. And Krishna left. His pastimes were over. Maitreya left to go to the north country. Vidura came and saw Uddhava. He spoke 3 or 4 chapters worth of subject matter with Uddhava about Krishna, and it went through the whole night, and in the morning Uddhava said, I have to go now. Krishna's given me some service, it's now the morning, but you should go find Maitreya. He went that way. And Krishna wanted Maitreya to speak transcendental knowledge to you, Vidura. And Vidura was thrilled. Krishna thought of me. Krishna thought of me. Of all the people, he thought of me just before leaving. How fortunate, how blessed that Krishna thought of me. But he was also feeling terrible. Krishna's gone. So in that condition, he went to find Maitreya. He found Maitreya. A wonderful exchange as the two great personalities met. And he submitted a number of questions to Maitreya about Krishna. And Maitreya then spoke. And Maitreya is, just to give you some idea of, even before Maitreya heard Uddhava Gita and became a perfected soul just from hearing. Note, you can become a perfected soul just from hearing. Just from hearing. But before that, he was so qualified that Vyasadeva was one of his friends. Imagine. And because he told Vidura, I know who you are. You're Yamaraj. Because I know this because Vyas told me. Because Vyas was the biological father or the father of Vidura. And he explained the whole that nobody else knew. But he knew because he heard it from Vyas. Such is the caliber of Maitreya, just to give you a picture of the person who is speaking. He then says, your good self is one of the eternal associates of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, for whose sake the Lord, while going back to his abode, left instructions with me. Krishna told me, Maitreya, to speak to you. He gave me instructions. He gave me some service. And now here you are. So here comes the service. I shall therefore describe to you the pastimes. The Sanskrit is Bhagavat Leela. We know what Leela means. It's not like what we do. We do is karma. And what Krishna does is Leela. It's transcendental pastime. Bhagavat Leela. I shall describe to you the pastimes by which the personality of Godhead extends his transcendental potency for the creation, maintenance, and dissolution of the cosmic world as they occur one after another. Cyclical creation, maintenance, destruction, resting for some time. Again, creation. So he's going to describe, he's saying specifically that. And it's other places in the Bhagavatam that says the same, that creation is a leela. We normally think, you know, Damodar leela, Krishna's stealing butter from the storerooms of Mother Jasoda and feeding to the monkeys, and Mother Jasoda comes with a stick and Krishna cries and she throws away the stick and she tries to tie. All that nice, that's leela. Krishna's lifting Govardhan Hill. It's Leela. And, you know, Leela. But creation is now also being included as the Lord's Leela. And here's the Leela in the next verse in purport. The personality of Godhead, the master of all living entities, existed prior to the creation as one, without a second. It is by his will only that creation is made possible. Not Big Bang, not primordial soup, but by his will only. And again, everything merges into him. The Supreme Self is symptomized by different names. In the purport, Prabhupada is speaking, writing, this is a commentary by Maitreya on the first of the Chaturshloki verses of the Bhagavatam. So what does that mean? What are the Chaturshloki verses of the Bhagavatam? They're the four verses that the essence of the entire 18,000 verses is expressed in these four verses. So that means like they're very important and they're very compact. And the impersonalists like things that they can, you know, interpret, where this means that instead of this means this and that means that. So the verse, the first of the Chaturshloki verses is, it begins, Aham Evasam Evagre. It's described in the purport. Aham Evasam Evagre. So the verse translates it basically, Krishna saying to Lord Brahma, before creation existed, I alone existed. During the period of cosmic manifestation, I alone exist. And after cosmic annihilation, guess what? I alone exist. So the impersonalists like it. They say, just see, this proves. Brahman is all that is. And this other thing that we call creation, it's false, and all there is Brahman. That's how they interpret. And Prabhupada gets out his weaponry and lets them have it. Because it's a misinterpretation on many levels, but starting with, the word aham is a person. It's first person singular. So how are we to understand? It's now going to be explained in the next verse. That Krishna, so this is now, he went away. Mahavishnu, what happened? So Mahavishnu is reclining in the causal ocean. The place of the causal ocean is where? Causal ocean is also known. Another name for the causal ocean is the river Virja. There's matter in the realm of matter, and there's spirit in the realm of spirit. And the river Virja is the dividing line between matter and spirit. So on this side is the material creation, on the other side of the river is the spiritual realm. The river Virja is the separating place. That's where Mahavishnu lies, in the causal ocean or the river Virja. So, the Lord, there he is, Mahavishnu, the undisputed proprietor of everything, was the only seer. The cosmic manifestation was not present at that time. Listen to this. And thus he felt imperfect. Called a Leela. He's not imperfect. But he can feel things because he's a person, and he can feel whatever he wants to feel, and one of them is this one. He's feeling imperfect. Why? Without his plenary and separated parts and parcels. So the separated parts and parcels, they're within him. The conditioned part and parcels. They're within him where consciousness is in this susupti state. Time, the factor of creation, has been withdrawn and is resting within him. And so because time is not acting, karma is not acting. Karma is also dormant, just like when you're under anesthesia. You're not doing things and you're not receiving the reactions of your having done things. The actions and reactions are inoperative in that susupti state. So he knows. And he's contemplating those living entities that are within him. And he's feeling, Mahavishnu is feeling, imperfect. The material energy was dormant, whereas the internal potency, Rama Devi, was manifested. Now listen to the purport. There's either two or three, it depends on how you read it, causes of creation. And it's not a Big Bang and it's not primordial soup. Primordial soup is an interesting one. Fiction. There's, once upon a time, there's a primordial soup. No cook. Don't ask where the ingredients came from either. It's just there's a primordial soup. Because it's primordial. Come on, you say God, we say primordial soup. It just existed. Primordial. Beyond time. And there's this primordial soup, just like souping around. And here comes a bolt of lightning. So electricity, some energy goes into the soup, and some parts of the soup get together and form amino acids. Whoa. And then more time passes, and more, and some amino acids get together with other amino acids. And make some proteins. Hey, let's get together and make a protein. Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay. So now you got the building blocks for life. You got proteins. And then the proteins connect with other proteins and And you get, you know, single-celled living entities made up of proteins. And then time passes and they evolve into other things and other things and other things. And then you get, you know, monkeys and you get human beings. That's how we got here. Okay, you get an A in your exam. Very good. But don't bring God into the picture. Because this is a public school. God isn't allowed in public schools. Don't bring this God stuff into the picture. It's the primordial soup if you want an A in your exam. Okay, so this is the Vedic picture. There's the Supreme Lord with the living entities in a dormant condition, with their karma suspended, with time not operative, time as we know it not operative, and the Lord is feeling something. He's feeling imperfect. Purport. The Lord is the supreme seer because only by his glance did the material energy become active for cosmic manifestation. At that time, the seer was there. But the external energy over which the glance of the Lord is cast was not present. It was present in a what's called pradhan. You're going to see the word pradhan in a minute. It's the undifferentiated totality of material substance. Like Einstein said, matter is neither created nor destroyed. Energy is not created or destroyed. So it's one of God's energies. It's his external energy. So he has his internal energy, Rama, and the external energy is the reflection of his internal energy. Like there's an object, and there's the reflection of the object. It's called chaya, or reflection. So there's chaya Devi, his external energy, and she's not doing anything. He felt somewhat insufficient, like a husband feeling lonely in the absence of his wife. This is a poetic simile, by the way, Prabhupada writes. The Lord wanted to create the cosmic manifestation. Here's one of the reasons for creation. It's the desire of the Lord. There's a Sanskrit term for it, which we're going to read in just a moment, called Icha. Like the verse of Bhagavad Gita, Icha dvesha savutena dvandva mohina bharata. Icha means will. He wanted something. And when the Lord wants something, guess what? It happens. It happens just because he wants it. Because he desires it, then his energies carry out his desire. That's what his energies are for, to carry out his desire. That's why they exist. That's why we exist. We're also his energy. That's what we're supposed to be doing, is carrying out the will of the Lord. And you know, we can misuse that option to do that or not do that. And that determines our circumstance of life. In the material or the spiritual realm. The Lord wanted to create the cosmic manifestation to give another chance to the conditioned souls who were dormant in forgetfulness. They're within him and he's wishing they should... I want them to have the opportunity to become free from this dormant, covered, materially contaminated consciousness and enjoy and loving pastimes with me. That was his feeling incomplete. The Lord is so kind that in the absence of such manifestation, he feels something wanting, and thus the creation takes place. That's one. Although the creation of the internal potency was manifested, the other potency appeared to be sleeping, and the Lord wanted to awaken her to activity. Second thing. So those living entities, that's one of his energies. And the external energy, another one of his energies. She's wanting to do some service, but she doesn't have some service. So let me give her something to do. So he gives her something to do. He does it just by glancing upon her. And that's what you see in the picture, his glancing upon, that's Durga, but Durga is another name of the external energy of the Lord. He glances upon the external energy to give her something to do. Boy, does she do a lot. It is the compassion of the Lord for the sleeping energy that he wants to see her awaken for enjoyment, like the other wives who are awake. The whole process is, repeating, to enliven the sleeping conditioned souls to the real life of spiritual consciousness so that they may thus become as perfect as the ever liberated souls in the Vaikuntha Lokas. Since the Lord is Satchitananda Vigraha, he likes every part and parcel of his different potencies to take part in the blissful rasa, because participation with the Lord in his eternal rasa lila is the highest living condition, perfect in spiritual bliss and eternal knowledge. End of purport. So that's like, okay, our Vedic picture of creation is there is this cyclical event where, in a resting state, the Lord is in his state of yoga nidra. It's described like this in Sri Brahma Samhita. And he's enjoying internally with his internal potency. We don't see Rama Devi because sometimes she's manifest externally, kind of like as we see Sita, Ram, Lakshmi, Narayan, Radha, Krishna. But we don't always see Rama, because in this case, she's in within him and he is enjoying pastimes with her within himself in a yoga nidra state. But she's there and they're enjoying eternal pastimes. As he's enjoying with Rama, he has this, what we just read in the Bhagavatam. Naturally, there's symmetry between Brahma Samhita and the Bhagavatam. He desires these two things: to awaken the souls that are in their dormant state, to rectify their condition of material attraction, again to come to their loving attraction. And to give, the second is to give his external energy some service. So now I'm just going to read one of the many verses of Sri Brahma Samhita, but there's a reason for it. Text 7. Krishna, translation, text 7. Krishna never consorts with his illusory energy. He's consorting with his Rama, his internal potency, but not his external potency. Still, her connection is not entirely cut off from the absolute truth. When he intends to create the material world, the amorous pastime, comma, in which he engages by consorting with his own spiritual chit potency, Rama, by casting his glance at the deluding energy in the shape of sending his time energy. So there's the glance of the Supreme Lord, and with the glance goes the time energy, is considered an auxiliary function. So sometimes you need a dictionary when you read Bhaktisiddhanta's writings. What's an auxiliary function? It means secondary. There's primaries, what Mahavishnu does or Ram does or Krishna does or Narayan does. They enjoy pastimes with their internal potency. Creation is a secondary or auxiliary function, which is he, Mahavishnu, desires to create a place for the living entities to practice devotional service and correct their misdirected attention and return their attention back to him. So he doesn't do anything that the verse is saying specifically. He has no direct contact. But it's not alone that his energy is working either. Rather, Rama understands his will because she's his internal potency, so she knows what he wants. And then she assists him because she's his potency, and she transforms one of her internal potencies, the time energy or kala shakti, into another suitable for the external energy manifestation of time. And hopefully this works. Here we go. So with his glance, So with his glance, two things. Time energy, kala shakti, and the living entities that are during the resting state within him. Rama Devi, this is our picture of creation. Rama Devi carries the living entities and her own time energy, which is a transformation of her, entrusts both to Shambhu. It's like a handoff. And Shambhu is the glance. There's in Sri Brahma Samhita, there's detailed descriptions, several verses describing who is Shambhu. He is the glance, and he, Shambhu, carries the glance to the material energy. Now this Kala Shakti, I'm going to read again what Bhaktisiddhanta writes in his purport of this verse. The deluding energy, that's Durga, as the maid servant of the spiritual chit potency Rama, she's the expansion of, or the reflection of, the internal potency, the external potency. The deluding energy, as the maidservant of the spiritual chit potency Rama, serves the manifested plenary portion of Godhead, Mahavishnu, consorted with Rama, the time energy. She serves him by receiving the time energy, representing the force of activity and instrumentality of Rama. Hence, there is found the process of masculinity, or the creative force. So, Lord Shambhu is that masculinity, and he's carrying these energies of Rama. The Icha Shakti of Rama, she knows his desire, the Mahavishnu's desire, so her Icha Shakti plus the force of activity, or Kriya Shakti, is carried to the material energy. So now comes little terminology. I'll go through it quickly. There is, you've heard this word pradhan, because I mentioned it earlier. Pradhan is the totality of all material energy in its dormant state, undifferentiated state. It's like a big jumbled warehouse. Or it's like the primordial soup. Everything is there. But it exists in relation to Mahavishnu. It's his energy, or it's the expansion of Rama Devi in the totality of material energy in its undifferentiated state. What's going to happen is, by the glance, the elements differentiate out. Starting with our most favorite one, false ego. When the glance, Shambhu, contacts Pradhan, the elements start to separate out. The first one that separates out is false ego. And then false ego mixes with the modes of nature, because they were also dormant. But once they're energized by the glance of the Lord, this time energy and the living entities, then the modes of nature start getting activated. So the mode of goodness interacts with false ego, and the material mind is produced. False ego interacts with the mode of passion. Material intelligence is produced. False ego interacts with the mode of ignorance. A whole lot of stuff is produced. Ignorance is very productive. The five gross elements. And then from the five gross elements, the five knowledge acquiring senses, the five working senses, and the five objects of the senses. You get 20 things from false ego interacting with the mode of ignorance. So you get the elements of creation through the glance of Mahavishnu as the, in the form of Shambhu contacting Pradhan. Those of you that have read Chaitanya Charitamrita or will in the future read, you'll come across these terms, Upadan, Maya. Upadan Maya is the material causal principle. I'll do it this way. Just like when there's production of a child, there's the act of procreation, and then the womb of the mother performs two functions. One, the womb of the mother supplies the ingredients for the development of the child. That's one thing. That's this principle. And the other is the chamber in which the child grows. That's the next one. It's called Nimitta Maya or Adhara Shakti in the language of Sri Brahma Samhita, the accommodating chamber, like the womb of a mother, the accommodating chamber. But so one is the space or the accommodating chamber in which the child grows, and the other is the ingredients. There are two aspects of Maya, the receiver of the glance of the Supreme Lord. One is the Pradhan aspect, and the other is this called Nimitta aspect or Adhara aspect or efficient cause, sometimes also called immediate cause, and that becomes agitated, this by the glance. And then these energies, this Ichha Shakti and Kriya Shakti, stir up or activate the accommodating chamber of Maya. And so, the opportunity, the dormant state of matter becomes activated. So here's our picture. Here's the primordial soup. Is it where it came from? It didn't just like, don't ask us where it came from, it's primordial. That's not our answer. It's an energy of the Supreme Lord. And what brings it into being? The Supreme Lord brings it into being. And He agitates it by His glance, which causes this part to then separate out into the ingredients. The differentiated ingredients come out. And then the chamber, accommodating chamber, or in other language, the efficient cause or the immediate cause, like the womb of the mother, there is the place where the child comes from. So a second aspect of Maya is, after having received the glance from the contact of Shambhu, these potencies, three potencies, are acting. The desire potency, it's the desire of the Supreme Lord, but more specifically, it's Rama Devi's desire to assist the Supreme Lord, but now it's being transmitted to Maya, so now she has a desire to fulfill the desire of the Supreme Lord. And it's a twofold desire. To rectify their condition, that's the higher desire. And then to give the living entities an opportunity to carry out their aspiration to be independent enjoyers, this also gives the facility for independent enjoyment, which can't happen, and therefore it's illusory enjoyment. Like today, one of the Chinese students that we met with wanted to know, what's the definition of happiness? Well, it's not this. But the sense that it's happiness, that's Maya. And what allows Maya to give one the sense of happiness is these three things, Jnana Shakti, Bala Shakti, or Isha Shakti, and Kriya Shakti. Some of you may know this nice verse, Parasha Shaktir Vividaiva Shruyate Swabhaviki Jnana Bala Kriyacha. You've heard that one. Some of you have heard that one. It's from the Upanishads. I believe it's Svetashvatara Upanishad. Parasha Shaktir Vividaiva, that the Supreme has unlimited potencies, among which are these three. And these three are needed to activate Maya so we can either be in Maya or get free from that tendency to be in Maya through having bodies and having the opportunity to do devotional service because we have this body. Okay, so here's the picture. This is Mahavishnu, and he is acting like a potter, and then there are these two things that the potter uses, clay and a potter's wheel. So the clay, which the potter uses, is like pradhan, the ingredients. And the potter's wheel is where he makes the pot, upon which, or in this case, the chamber in which creation takes place. So there's the womb of the mother, and there's the womb of the entire material energy that allows for forms of life and planets and things. That's our Vedic picture. Now, here's the same image, and we'll go through who the personalities involved. There's Mahavishnu. Resting within Mahavishnu is Rama, with whom he's engaged in pleasure pastimes, transcendental pastimes. There's the glance, Shambhu, and there's Maya. So he's glancing over this Maya. There are two metaphors that help us understand what's happening. One is, watch, Mahavishnu's name is going to change to a powerhouse. What does a powerhouse do? Powerhouse generates electricity. And then the electricity runs through an electric wire to some electrified device. So using that worldly example, this is what's happening. Mahavishnu is the powerhouse, and his energy is electricity, and through the electric wires, with the glance of Mahavishnu, the object, Maya, becomes electrified. And then in these two features, the elements of creation and the place for the accommodating space for the creation with those three energies, Jnana Shakti, Bala Shakti, and Kriya Shakti. Now, living entities haven't started to do anything yet, they're just setting up the system or facility. Here's an example that you'll find in Bhagavad Gita purport, I think it's 9:10 purport, where the relationship between Mahavishnu and the material energy is compared to the person who's smelling a flower and the smelling power of the person and the flower's fragrance. Just like the verse that I read from Sri Brahma Samhita, Mahavishnu never contacts Maya. He does so through his glance. Similarly, just as when you smell a flower, someone offers a flower at Arti. You don't have to put your nose on the flower. You can, but then the next person may get something in it besides the flower. You don't have to put your nose on the flower. You can, by the smelling power, you can smell the fragrance if there's some fragrance in the flower. So this is used to explain the relationship between the Lord and his energy, who he never directly contacts, but he contacts through the agency of the glance, Shambhu. Simply, as the smelling power contacts the fragrance of the flower. And then the next thing that's described, it's more detailed. I'm not going to go into the more detail so much. But so we have this condition where the material energy is now activated. The next step that happens is, within the body of Mahavishnu, who is reclining like this in the causal ocean, there are little tiny seeds, subtle, not like, you know, they're not covered by matter yet, they're subtle seeds of a universe. And he exhales. And as he exhales, from the pores of his skin where those seeds of universes come, they enter into this pradhan and adhara shakti place. So there's elements, and the elements start to congeal around the seeds, and the seeds then in that way become enlarged. And then some other things happen, you know, which I don't, that's another class, and some more things happen. But that's our picture of creation. And so after the universes then expand, This is this part of the cyclical thing. This is like, you know, kick off and get the game started. And then the game's over. The game is over by the Lord withdrawing his time energy. He does it without having to do anything, because that's how he does things. He says he desires it, and because it's Rama's time energy, she withdraws the time energy. This is the 12th canto Bhagavatam. There's creation, and then, you know, like 2013, and then there's annihilation at some point. So time energy is withdrawn. When time energy is withdrawn, it's susupti time again. The living entity's karma comes to a screeching halt because time moves it. Let's do it the other way. Without time, you don't have events. With time, you have events. Let's do it again. Without time. So he withdraws, or she withdraws her time energy. Karma stops. Time stops. The modes of material nature stop. The living entities are again withdrawn within the body of Mahavishnu. The elements go back to their primordial pradhan state. And there's a long period, 4,320,000,000 years of cosmic annihilation. And when the bell rings, what we just read from the Bhagavatam happens again. He desires. He's feeling something. It's a pastime. He wishes the living entities to again be in their relationship with him in a loving way. And then it happens again in a cyclical fashion. So it's his internal energy, his marginal energy, that's us, the living entities, and his external energy. The time energy is essential. We know from Bhagavad Gita introduction, there's five main subject matters in Bhagavad Gita. Do you know what they are? Let's hear them.
Time.
Karma. The living entity, the jiva. God. Material nature. Yeah. So, what we hear a lot about in Bhagavad Gita, what we hear the most about is about Krishna and about the modes of nature. We hear a lot about the modes of nature, material nature. And there's, you know, something about karma. But we don't hear so much about time. But time is like really essential in the process of creation. Time energy animates and activates. It's like the electricity that runs the machine. The material energy is like a machine. Yantra rudani mayaya. Without the power, it doesn't run. You need an operator too. You need the living entities to operate the machine. So here we are, inside the machine. But without time, the machine doesn't run either. So it's a very, you know, in, who has seen time? Anybody seen one somewhere? There goes time. It's subtle, but it's an energy that without which you don't have creation. You don't have events. The unseen hand of God moves events. Time energy is necessary. I think it's time to end the class. But this is like a little invitation for those of you that have children or think that one day you may have children or you're a child. And you'd like to understand what's the Vedic picture of how does creation come into being? That's just one of the things that material scientists speak about. That's, you know, factually, it's a compulsory subject matter that anyone who's enrolled at a public school must learn. You have to learn it. Big Bang. Right? What year in science did you study Big Bang? Huh? Freshman? Ninth grade. Big bang. If you want to get an A in the exam, you got to know about it. Don't talk about God, because you get an F. But so how are you going to be a young person growing up and you'll put get your A in your exam at the same time you're not bewildered? How do things fit together? So I'm inviting. Please read. It's a little bit like chewing sawdust. It's a little not easy to chew, to read that section of the Bhagavatam. But it's very, very important, on the other hand. Because otherwise, what you get is the picture that's sentiment. And people will just, you know, the scientist personality will just laugh at you. This is just sentiment. God. Anybody knows that gets A's in their exams that everything comes from the Big Bang, not from God. Anyway, so it behooves you to not just so you don't get bewildered. Now go back to Kripamoya saying it's what he's experienced in congregations through the 30 years that he's been working with congregations. It's a stumbling block. People have doubts. You know, can I really invest faith in this process of bhakti because science says something else? Maybe some persons don't, it's not a big deal, but some persons it's a big deal. And for those persons that it is a big deal, you can help them by here's a Vedic picture. And it's not, you know, a fairy tale. It's knowledge of this wisdom of the Vedas that's giving us this picture. Anyway, I invite you to read Srimad Bhagavatam carefully. And another part of what, besides what Kripamoya said about congregation having problems in these two areas, I decided last year around Christmas time that I wanted to make a presentation on this little book that, like many of Prabhupada's books or BBT publications, they make a nice place in your bookshelf and they don't get read so often. And this is one when you open it and you start to read it, you go, oh boy. Krishna book, please. Lilamrita, that's very easy to read. Oh, where's my dictionary? Okay. So I have lots of underlinings, but I wanted to go through it. And it's so rich. Here's something you'll appreciate, I think. I appreciate. In 1967, that was really early in our Hare Krishna movement, October 1967, Pradyumna, who was a Sanskritist, Prabhupada called him Panditji, because he was very learned, found a copy of Sri Brahma Samhita and asked Prabhupada, is it okay to read it? And Prabhupada wrote back in the letter, all of my disciples, I want them to thoroughly study this book that we normally keep on our bookshelf and understand its contents very carefully. In this book, it's teaching that Krishna is the source of everything. And in a synopsis form, it's giving a summary of the whole message of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So I want my disciples to thoroughly study and understand this literature, especially because it was commented upon by my spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So that alone is impetus for me to thoroughly study it and try to present it in a way that's not sawdust. It's palpable. Because if we can understand, here's a Sadaputta statement. The way that we view the world has a profound impact on how we view ourselves. So if the view of the world is impersonal, the beginning is nothing, the end is nothing, and in between is, what is it? Nothing. Nothingness. That's not a very nice way to think of ourselves and one another. And it does, you know, so we'll live some ethical way just because it's convenient. But really, the real story is, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Nothing is real. Whew. So, to rescue ourselves and others who are dear to us from that space, that disposition, that mentality, the spiritual conception that has foundation to it, scriptural foundation. And anyway, it's that makes it nice. It helps us be very clear about who we are in our relationship with the personality of God, the intention of the creation, and how to properly use it, impetus to properly use it as it was intended by the Creator. Okay, so it's 9 o'clock. I'll end. Hare Krishna. Any discussion? Anju? There are some
material desires.
We
stay in a certain level in our subconscious mind.
Yeah.
We might be coming from our past life.
Sure.
If we don't fulfill it, we might be longing for this in future.
Well, there's another option besides fulfill it, and that's cleanse it. This is a commercial, a cleanser commercial. Stronger than dirt. Boom, boom, boom. Get out that cleanser in. That's another option. Or a combination of the two. Some stains are very stubborn, so you know, you have to bleach them or something. But, you know, so that's not the only option, is fulfill them. Fulfill them is one option. Those that are dovetailable to Krishna is another option, under the regulations of the codes of the Vedas, and cleanse them is another option. I could elaborate, but that's a short answer. So if you have options, know that you have options. And then you take that which is within your capacity to do, one or the other or the other. You want to, Jivana, you have something? Yeah.
In the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, there's a hierarchy given of the soul, intelligence,
mind.
And then the false ego mixing with goodness produces the mind. It seems like that paradigm, the intelligence, seems higher than the mind, and then this paradigm, because goodness is generally seen higher than passion, one would think that it's conditioned standpoint, that false ego plus goodness should really equal intelligence. So
the answer is, in order to have, just consider universities, in order to have material activity, you need material intelligence. So go to that university and get the material intelligence so you can get a job and create material things. You need material intelligence. That's the mode of passion. It's the fruit of the mode of passion. And the mind has different functions, thinking, feeling, willing. But so depending, it has the capacity to be reflective or to contemplate rather than just like get it done, guide it and do it. It has the capacity. It can be your greatest enemy also, but it can be your best friend if it's directed in the proper way. So the reflective state of the mode of goodness. Passion is, intelligence is discerning this from that in order to get material desires fulfilled. So it's the paradigm is a different paradigm other than, you know, these are stages of consciousness, matter, mind, or gross body and senses, mind. Intelligence is more subtle than mind. And when things are in proper order, the intelligence gives direction to the mind. That's when things are in proper order. But usually it's the other way around. The senses are demanding to the mind, I want something. And the mind goes to the intelligence. Can you take care of this for me? Because the senses won't leave me alone. Okay. I'll go get a degree and figure out how to do it, and then, you know, I'm with you. The intelligence serves the mind's dictates, which are serving the senses' dictates. It's upside down. The soul is lost, from vision at least. So putting things in proper order, intelligence is necessary to direct the mind, to direct the senses, under the guidance of the soul or those who are spiritually realized. So it's a different paradigm than where the elements come from, the modes of nature. Okay?
Is it true then that the intelligence in the Bhagavad Gita paradigm is describing spiritual intelligence versus the other ones material intelligence? Or is that in harmony with the
Let's say, just like everything, as far as the modes of nature are concerned, is there not knowledge that's in the modes of nature? Aren't there intelligences like how to destroy something, how to create something, how to elevate something? Different categories of intelligence according to the modes of nature. Minds that are very dark. The modes of nature are acting on those. The intelligence, the mind, and the senses. Does that help? Someone else? Yes?
Mara, we were hearing that one of the reasons Krishna created the universe was because he wanted us to come out of that dormant phase, I guess.
Yes.
So we hear that we were once with Krishna, so were we in that dormant phase, or were we...
This is a cyclical thing. What you just are repeating is the cyclical. Within the material conditioned state, whether it's during the creation or during the cosmic annihilation, resting period, dormant. Both are material. Material, or material, just phases of material. The other thing that you're referring to is something else. It's the origin of the jiva question. Different than the cyclical positions of creation and annihilation position. Okay? Someone, yes?
Is Prabhadevi and Yogamaya the same?
Yes. There's within Bhaktisiddhanta's presentation, there are about five names. Niyati is one, internal potency. Ramadevi is another. Yoganidra is another. Yogamaya is another. Forget the other one. There's another one. And they're the same entity, the same person, simply describing a function. Same entity. Just like, you know, your son may call you something and your husband will call you something and someone else will call you something. But you're one person, depending upon the function you're performing or the relationship, there may be a nomenclature. For us, so what to speak of Ramadevi. Same entity. Yes?
Remind you of reading the third canto that time is an impersonal energy of the Supreme Lord. Would you kindly elaborate?
Time is a big, mysterious topic. There's a nice purport in the second canto that says like 7-8 things about time. And because it's 9:10, to go into it in detail, there isn't time to do it. But it depends. Just like the absolute truth is understood in three different features. Similarly, the energies of the Supreme Lord, they can be thought of as energies or principles or persons. And ultimately, everything is person. Everything is resting upon person, including time. It's Shakti, and Shakti is a person, as Rama is a person, not just an entity or an impersonal thing. The time can be thought of in that way and spoken of in that way. But ultimately behind that feature of impersonal is person. I think that's the best way to say it. You have a question? Yes.
In relation to what Andrew was asking,
yeah.
If you want to use cleansing instead of fulfilling on a desire, is that by like chanting?
And yeah. Like yes, that? Yes. The internal potency cleanses stuff. So you bring yourself in contact with the supreme pure, you become pure. So that stuff festers in darkness, but bring in light, becomes it's removed. It's not like now you see it, now you don't. It's just not. It's removed. Now, so something the influence of a particular something from the past may be so strong that, at least it seems, that it's holding me back from the supreme pure. So then, you follow? It's not that the process of bhakti is limited. It's as powerful as Krishna is. It's unlimitedly powerful. However, a conditioned soul or many conditioned souls may be so strongly entangled in something, it's hard to move towards the light. So then they may need to do some other thing besides just cleansing. In addition to cleansing, some assisting effort, like dovetailing is one. That comes at the final stage of this Sri Brahma Samhita, where Brahma expresses to Krishna, after all these wonderful realizations and, you know, etc., he still has a desire, a material desire. He wants to create a universe. He has a material desire, but ours is not, now I don't want to create a universe, I want something, and then, you know, that something is connected to something in the past. That's where those desires come from. So now what to do? So the advice of the Supreme Lord to Brahma is to join that something as a service unto the Supreme with the activities of direct devotional service, hearing and chanting, etc. Bhaktisiddhanta uses dovetail. So if there's something going on, I can dovetail that, perhaps, if it's offerable to Krishna. And there are some things that are just not offerable to Krishna. And then, you know, then I'm in a compromised position, so then I need the stronger cleansing effort. In some cases, someone may have to, like as Prabhupada did in the beginning of the Hare Krishna movement. He didn't start it with regular principles. If somebody, he was asked, he provided them. But if somebody was struggling with the principles, he didn't say, you know, garbage bin for you. He said, you know, just, you regulate that something. I wasn't there, but I was told Prabhupada said, you have a smoking habit, smoke one in the morning and one in the evening. Who wants to smoke in the morning anyways? But regulate it. Even people, anyway. So something that isn't so offerable to Krishna, then you regulate it while doing these other things. And then, you know, take assistance from people who are particularly skilled in helping people to become disentangled from things that they're entangled with. Join that with, you know, the core activity, hearing and chanting and dovetailing our lives with Krishna service. Okay? Got it? Yes.
Yes, on yesterday class, we had a beautiful statement, love your neighbors like how you want to love yourself.
Yes.
That one statement you said yesterday, I was contemplating on it the whole day today.
Great.
I mean,
it's not original. That's something that Christ taught. Okay.
That is a good message.
Yeah.
But to follow it practically.
Yeah, that's a challenge.
Way too much.
Yeah.
We don't have the same love all the time, even to one person. It's very hard.
Yep.
Even your own child, your husband.
Yep.
Family,
yep.
Friends.
Yep.
The level of love, it kind of differs.
Sure does.
Like loving.
That's because we're unsteady, though. Now, that's the conditioned state. So now, here's what you do, because I think what you're going is, how do we follow this? Here's the goal, I'm down here. Honestly, I'm down here. And even down here is like up and down, you know, sine curve, hills and valleys. And that's even, you know, that which is closest to me and most dear to me, what to speak of. So then there's the goal. So know what the goal is. That's very important to know what the goal is, Prabhupada's teaching. And it's also very important to be self-honest. This is where I am. That's the goal. This is where I am. Now, what can I do? What's doable step for me to? One step, not 10, 20, 500, 5 million. One step that's doable towards the goal. And, you know, in this particular case, I would recommend, well, start within the family. Charity begins at home. Start within the family. Make, you know, a steady condition of loving atmosphere within the family. And do that nicely for some time. And then think, okay, how can I expand that circle? And it'll just naturally grow on its own. But even to do that with the first next step, there has to be something else that's connecting your effort to reach the goal. And that's like descending mercy. You know, it's not only the desire to do so, it's descending mercy. The realization is, without descending mercy, I can't even do the first step. I need both. That's our Vaishnava teaching. Effort and mercy. Effort towards the goal and descending mercy. Without which, I'm just going to be in this unsteady state. Same, I'll be stuck. And I want to stay stuck. Krishna! So we call on Krishna's mercy. And his dear devotees that can help us. You know, the bundle of sticks. You know that one. It'll give us strength that's beyond our own strength. Just through association. What a wonderful resource Krishna's provide. Go ahead.
Okay, like in last week's Sunday class, Lal Prabhu was giving a class, like even Ram exhibited that quality. He didn't have no enemies, like, but the other people, like the enemies, they considered Ram to be enemy.
Yeah.
He didn't have the mood of anything.
Correct.
With him.
Correct.
So even Lord exhibited that quality to show like how you have to love other person.
Yeah.
And like Prabhupada's lecture also said, hate the disease, don't hate the person.
Yeah.
So, like, well, I understand all that point.
But
when
the execution, there's this unsteady thing.
I get this impression if you're trying to satisfy everybody.
No. That's impossible. That's a fool's mission.
Then won't that bring attachment to this?
No, but it's not satisfied. You cannot. The message is to love, not, you know, so that's how what you feel. Like Ram had love. And some persons saw him in a different way than love. So you don't be attached to how people feel. You should concern yourself with how people feel, but you're not the controller of how people feel. That's up to them. From your side, act in a loving way. Act in a way that Krishna will be pleased with you. And our founder, Acharya Srila Prabhupada, will be pleased with you. On this side and on this side, there's two persons watching me, and they're smiling.
Towards me, and if that is going to create hatred towards that person, how do I eliminate that situation, or how do I react in that situation?
Well, it depends on your consciousness, how you process that kind of thing. One is you tolerate, another is you forgive, another is you see beyond the duality and you see there's a spirit soul, novel, and that spirit soul is suffering. And in their suffering condition, they're doing something, saying something that's not befitting a spirit soul, it's something else. And so they're suffering. I feel concern and compassion and care for that person. That's a Vaishnava way of looking at things. I mean, Haridasa Thakur. Or so many examples from our Vaishnava scripture. Okay. Suja.
Thanks for this nice explanation, class. Thank you very much. This is a small clarification question. So while during annihilation, always
during which annihilation?
Yes.
Okay.
Except the spiritual world, all the world goes back to the. I mean, all the living entities go back to the Kodam. So
no. No. The living entities go back within the body of Mahavishnu. The living entities extend from the body of Mahavishnu. Living entities go back into the body of Mahavishnu.
So my question is, like, the souls which are in the hellish planet?
I'm listening.
Undergoing whatever they have to.
Yes.
So during that time, so everything goes back.
Everything.
Even if they are halfway through, or
everything. Time is withdrawn, everything comes to a screeching halt.
So, with the next creation, so again they go back to
yes.
The
yes, it's Prabhupada gives this example. When you wake up in the morning, okay, now I remember who I am. You know, something that I experience is really kind of funny sometimes. The first thing that I have to do when I wake up is figure out where I am. Okay, where am I? Not like who am I, but where am I? But the living entities, it's like waking up. You know, they're everything is suspended and then it's activated. They just pick up where they left off. The living entities in the hellish planets and living entities in the, you know, the various forms of life. They just resume where they left off. Okay? Okay. Yes?
Spiritual world is eternal, right?
Spiritual world is?
Eternal.
Eternal. Sure.
So the annihilation doesn't differ?
No. Nor creation. You heard, remember what the verse that I read? That's what it says. If what to speak of Krishna Loka, even Mahavishnu, the external energy was dormant. The energy is eternally existing, but dormant and active, like Vyakta and Avyakta, manifest, unmanifest, activated, dormant. So the external energy was in a dormant state. Okay? Does that address your question?
But Krishna's external energy and marginal energy are eternally dormant.
No. The marginal energy, that's us. That's you and me and, you know, Prahlad and... He's not dormant. Yes.
All this is controlled or done by Mahavishnu, and Krishna is in the spiritual world.
He's in the spiritual world, but these are his expansions and his potencies. And so it's the only part that's dormant is sometimes The material energy is dormant. It sometimes is not dormant because he activates it through the agency of Mahavishnu, through the agency of Rama, through the agency of Shambhu, like, you know, chain reaction, cause and effect, like, you know, technology, how creation takes place. Krishna is forever enjoying eternal pastimes in Goloka Vrindavan. From time to time, yada yada hi dharma shaglani or bhavati, Krishna descends. So he does so by expansions, but it's his personal expansion. He descends. You got a question mark on your forehead. It's just silly. I'm not satisfying your question. Articulate your... Think about it. He's... Yeah. He's lying in the causal ocean. He's an expansion of Krishna. He's eternal. As Krishna is eternal, as living entities, they're co-eternal. And he sometimes is in yoga nidra. He seems to be asleep. But it's not like... not like us. It's a transcendental enjoyment with Rama within. Pastimes. He's not dormant. Living entities are not dormant. They're in a sleeping state, but they're conscious. Even Susupti is conscious. But it's a very covered state of consciousness. Matter is sometimes unmanifest, but it's still existing. It's in its pradhan state, undifferentiated total material energy, like a big jumbled up warehouse. Then it can separate out all the different parts. Okay.
So then the internal potential is said to be within Mahavishnu.
Yeah.
But in the case of Krishna, it is manifest as the spiritual.
She's always by his side. But it's one entity. Krishna and Krishna's potency, one entity. Radha Krishna, one entity. Two forms, one entity. Eternally. I'm going to move on.
The spiritual world is the manifestation of potency.
Sure. There's a science to that one too. Balaram manifests the spiritual world by his Sandini potency, which is part of the internal potency. The science is very complex. Stay tuned. I want to move on. And someone else? Comment, question? Okay. Yes, in the back. Yes.
I just want to know, so the Mahavishnu remained in that kind of ocean.
Yes. No. Well, if you read, have you read Krishna book? Parts of it? Read chapter 89. It's at the very end of the Krishna book, or 10th canto Bhagavatam. Krishna and Arjuna go to find the sons of the Brahmana who just disappeared after their birth. They get in a chariot and they go through the coverings of the universe into the spiritual sky. They go to the abode of Mahavishnu, who's lying in the causal ocean. But when the description is, when they reach the abode of Mahavishnu, he's in a palace. He's not lying in the causal ocean. But it's not a different person, it's just a different Leela, or a different function of the same personality. He can do lots of things. So there's a description of the palace in which Mahavishnu is situated, and he rises to receive Krishna and Arjuna, thanks them for coming. He says, here's the sons of the Brahmana. You were looking for, it was I who took them, because I wanted to see you. I knew you'd come. Here they are. You can now return them back to them. So there are different features or ways by which Mahavishnu manifests his pastimes. Sometimes Rama is outside of himself. Sometimes Rama is inside of himself. Sometimes he's lying on the causal ocean. Sometimes he's in a palace. But he's, as your question is he eternal? Yes. When this place is destroyed, he's not. His abode is not. It's eternal. There's a verse in Bhagavad Gita that says, there is such a place where when the whole cosmic manifestation is destroyed, that part remains. That's the abode of Shiradakshai Vishnu. Within this universe, there's one planet that's a spiritual planet called Shiradakshai Vishnu. When this place is destroyed, that part, that place remains. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. Yes? About which?
The pole star?
Yes, yes.
So how is that?
That's the place. That's Shiradakshai Vishnu's abode. That's the pole star. Or sometimes called the North Star in our, you know, Western astronomy. Part of the Big Dipper. And we can see the effulgence from it, but you know, ask the astronomers what it is. They don't say that, oh, that's Shiradakshai Vishnu's abode. When this is destroyed, that part remains. They don't say that. Is that okay? Yes.
Well, I have a basic question.
And this is our last question.
Then the living entity is basically, and he's free of enviousness, he get a qualification to go back to spiritual world.
Now, isn't that going to be very nice? Do you look forward to that?
But the other way, when we have envious attitude towards the Lord, that's the reason for the material existence.
That's the reason for our envious attitude towards other living beings also.
That's because of freedom?
It's misuse of free will. Yep. Yes, you can become released from that. Like, you know, Anju's question about something that's like very deep and Gopinath is past his bedtime. Oh, okay. It's Krishna book time. Time to read a book. He's very regulated, huh? No. He's curious, yes? Yes. Very curious. He likes pictures. Okay. Okay, we're going to end. Thank you very much to the Prabhupada. Peace. Yeah.